Uncanny Valley by Greg Egan. Narrated by Vikas Adam.
1. In a pause in the flow of images, it came to him that he'd been dreaming for a fathomless time and that he wished to stop. But when he tried to picture the scene that would greet him upon waking, his mind grabbed the question and ran with it. Not so much changing the subject as summoning out of the darkness answers that he was sure had long ago ceased to be correct. He remembered the bunk beds he and his brother had slept in until he was 9, with pieces of broken springs hanging down above him like tiny gray stalactites. The shade of his bedside reading lamp had been ringed with small diamond-shaped holes. He would place his fingers over them, and stare at the red light emerging through his flesh until the heat from the globe became too much to bear. Later, in a room of his own, his bed had come with hollow metal posts whose plastic caps were easily removed, allowing him to toss in chewed pencil stubs, pins that had held newly bought school shirts elaborately folded around cardboard packaging, tacks that he'd bent out of shape with misaligned hammer blows while trying to form pictures in zinc on lumps of firewood, pieces of gravel that had made their way into his shoes, dried snot scraped from his handkerchief, and tiny, balled-up scraps of paper, each bearing a 4 or 5 word account of whatever seemed important at the time, building up a record of his life like a core sample slicing through geological strata, a find for future archaeologists far more exciting than any diary. But he could also recall a bleary-eyed, low-angle view of clothes strewn on the floor, in a bedsit apartment with no bed as such, just a fold-out couch. That felt as remote as his childhood, but something pushed him to keep fleshing out the details of the room. There was a typewriter on a table. He could smell the ribbon, and he saw the box in which it had come, sitting on a shelf in a corner of a stationer's, with white letters on a blue background, but the words they spelled out eluded him. He'd always hunted down the fully black ribbons, though most stores had only stocked black and red. Who could possibly need to type anything in red? Wiping his ink-stained fingers on a discarded page after a ribbon change, he knew the whole scene was an anachronism, and he tried to follow that insight up to the surface, like a diver pursuing a glimpse of the distant sun. But something weighed him down, anchoring him to the cold wooden chair in that unheated room, with a stack of blank paper to his right, a pile of finished sheets to his left, a wastebasket under the table. He urgently needed to think about the way the loop in the E became solid black sometimes, prompting him to clean all the type bars with an old T-shirt dampened with methylated spirits. If he didn't think about it now, he was afraid that he might never have the chance to think of it again. 2. Adam decided to go against all the advice he'd received and attend the old man's funeral. The old man himself had warned him off.
"Why make trouble?" he'd asked,
peering at Adam from the hospital bed with that disconcerting vampiric longing that had grown more intense toward the end.
"The more you rub their faces in it, the more likely they'll be to come after you."
"I thought you said they couldn't do that."
"All I said was that I'd done my best to stop them. Do you want to keep the inheritance, or do you want to squander it on lawyers? Don't make yourself more of a target than you need to be."
But standing in the shower, reveling in the sensation of the hot water pelting his skin, Adam only grew more resolute. Why shouldn't he dare to show his face? He had nothing to be ashamed of. The old man had bought a few suits for him a while ago and left them hanging beside his own clothes. Adam picked one out and placed it on the bed, then paused to run a hand along the worn sleeve of an old olive-green shirt. He was sure it would fit him, and for a moment he considered wearing it, But then the thought made him uneasy, and he chose one of the new ones that had come with the suits. As he dressed, he gazed at the undisturbed bed, trying to think of a good reason why he still hadn't left the guest room. No one else was coming to claim this one. But he shouldn't get too comfortable here. He might need to sell the house and move into something far more modest. Adam started booking a car, then realized that he had no idea where the ceremony was being held. He finally found the details at the bottom of the old man's obit, which described it as open to the public. While he stood outside the front door waiting for the car, he tried for the third or fourth time to read the obituary itself, but his eyes kept glazing over. Morris, blah, blah, blah. Morris, blah, blah. Morris, blah. His phone beeped. Then the gate opened and the car pulled into the driveway. He sat in the passenger seat and watched the steering wheel doing its poltergeist act as it negotiated the U-turn. He suspected that whatever victories the lawyers could achieve, he was going to have to pay the unsupervised driving surcharge for a while yet. As the car turned into Sepulveda Boulevard, the view looked strange to him. Half familiar, half wrong, but perhaps there'd been some recent reconstruction. He dialed down the tinting, hoping to puncture a lingering sense of being at a remove from everything. The glare from the pavement beneath the cloudless blue sky was merciless, but he kept the windows undimmed. The venue was some kind of chapel-esque building that probably served as seven different kinds of meeting hall, and in any case was free of conspicuous religious or La La Land inspirational signage. The old man had left his remains to a medical school, so at least they'd all been spared a trip to Forest Lawn. As Adam stepped away from the car, he spotted one of the nephews, Ryan, walking toward the entrance, accompanied by his wife and adult children. The old man hadn't spent much time with any of them, but he'd gotten hold of recent pictures and showed them to Adam so he wouldn't be caught unaware. Adam hung back and waited for them to go inside before crossing the forecourt. As he approached the door and caught sight of a large portrait of a decidedly precancerous version of the old man on a stand beside the podium, his courage began to waver. But he steeled himself and continued. He kept his gaze low as he entered the hall and chose a spot on the frontmost unoccupied bench, far enough in from the aisle that nobody would have to squeeze past him. After a minute or so, an elderly man took the aisle seat. Adam snuck a quick glance at his neighbor, but he did not look familiar. His timing had turned out to be perfect. Any later, and his entrance might have drawn attention. Any earlier, and there would have been people milling outside. Whatever happened, no one could accuse him of going out of his way to make a scene. Ryan mounted the steps to the podium. Adam stared at the back of the bench in front of him. He felt like a child trapped in church, though no one had forced him to be here. "The last time I saw my uncle," Ryan began, "was almost 10 years ago, at the funeral of his husband, Carlos. Until then, I always thought it would be Carlos standing up here, delivering this speech, far more aptly and eloquently than I, or anyone else, ever could." Adam felt a freight train tearing through his chest, but he kept his eyes fixed on a discolored patch of varnish. This had been a bad idea, but he couldn't walk out now. "My uncle was the youngest child of Robert and Sophie Morris," Ryan continued. "He outlived his brother Stephen, his sister Joan, and my mother, Sarah. Though I was never close to him, I'm heartened to see so many of his friends and colleagues here to pay their respects. I watched his shows, of course, but then, didn't everyone? I was wondering if we ought to screen some kind of highlights reel, but then the people in the know told me that there was going to be a tribute at the Emmys,
and I decided not to compete with the professional edit bots. That line brought some quiet laughter, and Adam felt obliged to look up and smile. No one in this family was any kind of monster, whatever they aspired to do to him. They just had their own particular views of his relationship with the old man, sharpened by the lure of a few million dollars, but they probably would have felt the same regardless. Ryan kept his contribution short, but when Cynthia Navarro took his place, Adam had to turn his face to the pew again. He doubted that she'd recognize him. She'd worked with the old man in the wrong era for that, but the warmth and grief in her voice made her anecdotes far harder to shut out than the automated mashup of database entries and viral misquotes that had formed the obituary. She finished with the time they'd spent all night searching for a way to rescue a location shoot with 600 extras after Gemma Freeman broke her leg and had to be stretchered out in a chopper. As she spoke, Adam closed his eyes and pictured the wildly annotated pages of the script strewn across the table, and Cynthia gawping with incredulity at her friend's increasingly desperate remedies.
"But it all worked out well enough," she concluded. "The plot twist that no viewer ever saw coming, that lifted the third season to a whole new level, owed its existence to an oil slick from a generator that just happened to be situated between Ms. Freeman's trailer and..."
Laughter rose up, cutting her off, and Adam felt compelled once more to raise his eyes. But before the sounds of mirth had faded, his neighbor moved closer and asked in a whisper, "Do you remember me?" Adam turned, not quite facing the man. "Should I?" He spoke with an East Coast accent that was hard to place, and if it induced a certain sense of déjà vu, so did advertising voiceovers and random conversations overheard in elevators. "I don't know," the man replied. His tone was more amused than sarcastic. He meant the words literally. Adam hunted for something polite and noncommittal to say, but the audience was too quiet now for him to speak without being noticed and hushed, and his neighbor was already turning back toward the podium. Cynthia was followed by a representative of the old man's agents, though everyone who'd known him in the Golden Age was long gone. There were suits from Warner Brothers, Netflix, and HBO, whose stories of the old man were clearly scripted by the same bots that wrote their new shows. As the proceedings became ever more wooden, Adam began suffering from a panic-inducing premonition that Ryan would invite anyone in the hall who wished to speak to step up, and in the awkward silence that followed, everyone's eyes would sweep the room and alight on him. But when Ryan returned to the podium, he just thanked them for coming and wished them safe journeys home.
"No music?" Adam's neighbor asked. "No poetry? I seem to recall something by Dylan Thomas that might have raised a laugh under the circumstances."
"I think he stipulated no music," Adam replied.
"Fair enough. Since the big chill, anything you could pick with a trace of wit to it would seem like a bad in-joke."
"Excuse me, I have to." People were starting to leave, and Adam wanted to get away before anyone else noticed him. As he stood, his neighbor took out his phone and flicked his thumb across its surface. Adam's phone pinged softly in acknowledgement.
"In case you want to catch up sometime," the man explained cheerfully.
"Thanks," Adam replied, nodding an awkward goodbye, grateful that he didn't seem to be expected to reciprocate. There was already a small crowd lingering just inside the door, slowing his exit. When he made it out onto the forecourt, he walked straight to the roadside and summoned a car.
"Hey, you! Mr. 60%!
Adam turned. A man in his 30s was marching toward him, scowling with such intense displeasure that his pillowy cheeks had turned red.
"Can I help you with something?"
Adam asked mildly. For all that he'd been dreading a confrontation,
Now that it was imminent, he felt more invigorated than intimidated.
What the fuck were you doing in there?
It was open to the public.
You're not part of the public!
Adam finally placed him. He was one of Ryan's sons. He'd seen him from behind as he'd been entering the hall.
Unhappy with the will, are you, Gerald?
Gerald came closer. He was trembling slightly, but Adam couldn't tell if it was from rage or from fear.
Live it up while you can, 60. You're going to be out with the trash in no time.
What's with this 60?
As far as Adam knew, he'd been bequeathed 100% of the estate, unless Gerald was already accounting for all the legal fees.
60%! How much you resemble him!
Now that's just cruel. I'm assured that by some metrics it's at least 70.
Gerald snickered triumphantly, as if that made his case.
I guess he was used to setting the bar low. If you grew up believing that Facebook could give you news and Google could give you information, your expectations for quality control would already be non-existent.
I think you're conflating his generation with your father's.
Adam was quite sure that the old man had held the bilge barons in as much contempt as his great-nephew did.
And 70% of something really isn't so bad. Getting a side load that close to complete is orders of magnitude harder than anything those charlatans ever did.
We'll give your own scam artist a Nobel Prize, but you'd still need to be senile to think that was good enough.
He wasn't senile. We spoke together at least a dozen times in the month before he died, and he must have thought he was getting what he'd paid for, because he never chose to pull the plug on me.
Adam hadn't even known at the time that that was possible, but in retrospect, he was glad no one had told him. It might have made those bedside chats a little tense.
Because?
Gerald demanded. When Adam didn't reply immediately, Gerald laughed.
Or is the reason he decided you were worth the trouble part of the 30% of his mind that you don't have?
It could well be, Adam conceded, trying to make that sound like a perfectly satisfactory outcome. A joke about the studio's bots only achieving 10% of the same goal and still earning a tidy income got censored halfway to his lips. The last thing he wanted to do was invite the old man's relatives to view him in the same light as that cynical act of shallow mimicry.
So you don't know why he didn't care that you don't know whatever it is that you don't know? Very fucking Kafka.
I think you would have preferred very fucking Hella. But who am I to say?
Next week's trash, that's what you are.
Gerald stepped back, looking pleased with himself.
Next week's fodder for the wrecking yard.
The car pulled up beside Adam, and the door slid open.
Is that your grandma come to take you home?
Gerald taunted him.
Or maybe your retarded cousin?
Enjoy the wake,
Adam replied. He tapped his skull.
I promise, the old man will be thinking of you.
3. Adam had a conference call with the lawyers.
How do we stand? He asked.
The family's going to contest the will,
Gina replied.
On what grounds?
That the trustees and the beneficiaries of the trust misled and defrauded Mr. Morris.
They're saying I misled him somehow?
No, Corbin interjected. U.S. law doesn't recognize you as a person. You can't be sued as such, but other entities you depend on certainly can be.
Right.
Adam had known as much. But in his mind, he kept glossing over the elaborate legal constructs that sustained his delusions of autonomy. On a purely practical level, there was money in 3 accounts that he had no trouble accessing. But then, the same was probably true of any number of stock trading algorithms, and that didn't make them the masters of their own fate.
So who exactly is accused of fraud?
Our firm, Gina replied. various officers of the corporations we created to fulfill Mr. Morris's instructions. Lodestone, for making false claims that led to the original purchase of their technology, and for ongoing fraud in relation to the services promised in their maintenance contract.
I'm very happy with the maintenance contract.
When Adam had complained that one of his earlobes had gone numb, Sandra had come to his home and fixed the problem on the same day he called.
That's not the point, Corbin said impatiently.
Adam was forgetting his place again. Jurisprudentially, his happiness cut no ice.
So what happens next?
The first hearings are still 7 months away, Gina explained. We were expecting this, and we'll have plenty of time to prepare. We'll aim for an early dismissal, of course, but we can't promise anything.
No, Adam hesitated. But it's not just a house they could take? The Estonian accounts? Gina said.
Opening those accounts under your digital residency makes some things easier, but it doesn't put the money out of reach of the courts.
Right.
When they hung up, Adam paced the office.
Could it really be so hard to defend the old man's will? He wasn't even sure what disincentives were in place to stop the lawyers from drawing out proceedings like this for as long as they wished. Maybe a director of one of the entities he depended on was both empowered and duty-bound to rein them in if they were behaving with conspicuous profligacy. But Adam himself couldn't sack them or compel them to follow his instructions, just because Estonia had been nice enough to classify him as a person for certain limited purposes. The old man had believed he was setting him up in style, but all the machinery that was meant to support him just made him feel trapped. What if he gave up the house and walked away? If he cashed in his dollar and euro accounts for some mixture of blockchain currencies before the courts swept in and froze his funds, that might be easier to protect and enjoy without the benefits of a social security number, a birth certificate, or a passport. But those currencies were all insanely volatile, and trying to hedge them against each other was like trying to save yourself in a skydiving accident by clutching your own feet. He couldn't leave the country by any lawful means without deactivating his body so it could be sent as freight. Lodestone had promised to facilitate any trips he wished to make to any of the 39 jurisdictions where he could walk the streets unchaperoned, as proud and free as the pizza bots that had blazed the trail, but the idea of returning to the company's servers or even being halted and left in limbo for the duration of the flight filled him with dread. For now, it seemed that he was stuck in the valley. All he could do was find a way to make the best of it.
4. Sitting on two upturned wooden crates in an alley behind the nightclub, they could still hear the pounding bass line of the music escaping through the walls, but at least it was possible to hold a conversation here. Carlos sounded like the loneliest person Adam had ever met. Did he tell everyone so much so soon? Adam wanted to believe that he didn't, and that something in his own demeanor had inspired this beautiful man to confide in him. Carlos had been in the country for 12 years, but he was still struggling to support his sister in El Salvador. She'd raised him after their parents died. His father when he was 6 months old, his mother when he was 5. But now his sister had 3 children of her own, and the man who'd fathered them was no good to her.
I love her, he said. I love her like my own life. I don't want to be rid of her. But the kids are always sick, or something's broken that needs fixing. It never fucking stops.
Adam had no one relying on him, no one expecting him to do anything. His own finances waxed and waned, but at least when the money was scarce, no one else suffered or made him feel that he was letting them down.
So, what do you do to relieve the stress? He asked.
Carlos smiled sadly.
It used to be smoking, but that got too expensive. So you quit?
Only the smoking. As Adam turned toward him, his mind went roaming down the darkness of the alley, impatiently following the glistening thread, unable to shake off the sense of urgency that told him, "Take hold of this now, or it will be lost forever." He didn't need to linger in their beds for long. Just a few samples of that annihilating euphoria were enough to stand in for all the rest. Maybe that was the engine powering everything that followed, but what it dragged along behind it was like a newlywed's car decorated by 1,000 exuberant well-wishers. He tried grabbing the rattling cans of their fights, running his fingers over the rough texture of all the small annoyances and slights, mutually wounded pride, frustrated good intentions. Then he felt the jagged edge of a lacerating eruption of doubt. But something had happened that blunted the edge, then folded it in on itself again and again, leaving a seam, a ridge, a scar. Afterward, however hard things became, there was no questioning the foundations. They'd earned each other's trust, and it was unshakable. He pushed on into the darkness, trying to understand. Wherever he walked, light would follow, and his task was to make his way down as many side streets as possible before he woke. This time, though, the darkness remained unbroken. He groped his way forward, unnerved. They'd ended up closer than ever. He knew that with as much certainty as he knew anything. So why did he feel as if he was stumbling blindly through the rooms of Bluebeard's castle, and the last thing he should want to summon was a lamp? 5. Adam spent 3 weeks in the old man's home theater, watching every one of the old man's shows, and an episode or two from each of the biggest hits of the last 10 years. There could only be one thing more embarrassing than pitching an idea to a studio and discovering that he was offering them a story that they'd already produced for 6 seasons, and that would be attempting to recycle not just any old show, but an actual Adam Morris script. Most of the old man's work felt as familiar as if he'd viewed it 100 times in the editing suite, but sometimes a whole side plot appeared that seemed to have dropped from the sky. Could the studios have fucked with things afterward, when the old man was too sick and distracted to notice? Adam checked online, but the fan sites that would have trumpeted any such tampering were silent. The only recuts had taken place in another medium entirely. He desperately needed to write a new show. Money aside, how else was he going to pass the time? The old man's few surviving friends had all made it clear before he died that they wanted nothing to do with his side load. He could try to make the most of his cybernetic rejuvenation. His skin felt exactly like skin, from inside and out, and his ridiculously plausible dildo of a cock wouldn't disappoint anyone if he went looking for ways to use it. But the truth was, he'd inherited the old man's feelings for Carlos far too deeply to brush them aside and pretend that he was 20 again, with no attachments and no baggage. He didn't even know yet if he wanted to forge an identity entirely his own, or to take the other path and seek to become the old man more fully. He couldn't betray a lover 10 years dead who was, in the end, nothing more to him than a character in someone else's story. Whatever he'd felt as he dragged the old man's memories into his own virtual skull. But he wasn't going to sell himself that version of things before he was absolutely sure it was the right one. The only way to know who he was would be to create something new. It didn't even need to be a story that the old man wouldn't have written himself had he lived a few years longer, just so long as it didn't turn out that he'd already written it, pitched it unsuccessfully, and stuck it in a drawer. Adam pictured himself holding a page from each version up to the light together, bringing the words into alignment, trying to decide if the differences were too many or too few. 6.
$60,000 in 1 week?
Adam was incredulous. Gino replied calmly,
"The billables are all itemized. I can assure you, what we're charging is really quite modest for a case of this complexity."
The money was his. He could do what he liked with it. End of story.
That's not what the case law says.
Gino was beginning to exhibit microfidgets, as if she'd found herself trapped at a family occasion being forced to play a childish video game just to humor a nephew she didn't really like. Whether or not she'd granted Adam personhood in her own mind, he certainly wasn't anyone in a position to give her instructions, and the only reason she'd taken his call must have been some sop to Adam's comfort that the old man had managed to get written into his contract with the firm.
"All right. I'm sorry to have troubled you."
In the silence after he'd hung up, Adam recalled something that Carlos had said to the old man back in New York one sweltering July, taking him aside in the middle of the haggling over a second-hand air conditioner they were attempting to buy.
"You're a good person, cariño, so you don't see it when people are trying to cheat you."
Maybe he'd been sincere, or maybe good had just been a tactful euphemism for unworldly, though if the old man really had been so trusting, how had Adam ended up with the opposite trait? Was cynicism some kind of default, wired into the template from which the whole side-loading process had started? Adam found an auditor with no connections to the old man's lawyers, picking a city at random, and then choosing the person with the highest reputation score with whom he could afford a 10-minute consultation. Her name was Lillian Ajani.
"Because these companies have no shareholders," she explained, "there's not that much that needs to be disclosed in their public filings, and I can't just go to them myself and demand to see their financial records. A court could do that, in principle, and you might be able to find a lawyer who'd take your money to try to make that happen. But who would their client be?"
Adam had to admire the way she could meet his gaze with an expression of sympathy while reminding him that, shorn of the very constructs he was trying to scrutinize, for administrative purposes, he didn't actually exist.
"So there's nothing I can do?"
Maybe he was starting to confuse his secondhand memories of the real world with all the shows he'd been watching, where people just followed the money trail. The police never seemed to need to get the courts involved, and even civilians usually had some supernaturally gifted hacker at their disposal.
"We couldn't hire an investigator who could persuade someone to leak?"
Mike Ehrmantraut would have found a way to make it happen in 3 days flat. Miss Ajani regarded him censoriously.
"I'm not getting involved in anything illegal. But maybe you have something yourself, already in your possession, that could help you more than you realize."
"Like what?"
"How computer savvy was your predecessor?"
"He could use a word processor and a web browser. And Skype."
"Do you still have any of his devices?"
Adam laughed.
"I don't know what happened to his phone, but I'm talking to you from his laptop right now."
"Okay. Don't get your hopes too high, but if there were files containing financial records or legal documents that he received and then deleted, then unless he went out of his way to erase them securely, they might still be recoverable."
Miss Ajani sent him a link for a piece of software she trusted to do the job. Adam installed it, then stared numbly at the catalog of 83,000 intelligible fragments that had shown up on the drive. He started playing with the filtering options. When he chose text, portions of scripts began emerging from the fog, some instantly recognizable, some probably abandoned dead ends. Adam averted his gaze, afraid of absorbing them into his subconscious if they weren't already buried there. He had to draw a line somewhere. He found an option called financial, and when that yielded a blizzard of utility bills, he added all the relevant keywords he could think of.
There were bills from the lawyers, and bills from Lodestone. If Gina was screwing him, she'd been screwing the old man as well, because the hourly rate hadn't changed. Adam was beginning to feel foolish. He was right to be vigilant about his precarious situation, but if he let that devolve into full-blown paranoia, he'd just end up kicking all the support structures out from beneath his feet. Lodestone hadn't been shy with their fees either. Adam hadn't known before just how much his body had cost, but given the generally excellent engineering, it was difficult to begrudge the expense. There was an item for the purchase of the template, and then one for every side-loading session, broken down into various components. "Squid operator?" he muttered, bemused. "What the fuck?" But he wasn't going to start convincing himself that they'd blinded the old man with technobabble. He'd paid what he'd paid, and in the hospital he'd given Adam every indication that he'd been happy with the result. Targeted occlusions? Meaning blood clots in the brain? The old man had left him login details allowing him post-mortem access to all his medical records. Adam checked, and there had been no clots. He searched the web for the phrase in the context of sideloading. The pithiest translation he found was, "the selective non-transferal of a prescribed class of memories or traits," which meant that the old man had held something back, deliberately. Adam was an imperfect copy of him, not just because the technology was imperfect, but because he'd wanted it that way.
"You lying piece of shit."
Toward the end, the old man had rambled on about his hope that Adam would outdo his own achievements, but judging from his efforts so far, he wasn't even going to come close. Three attempts at new scripts had ended up dead in the water. It wasn't Ryan and his family who'd robbed him of the most valuable part of the inheritance. Adam sat staring at his hands, contemplating the possibilities for a life worth living without the only skill the old man had ever possessed. He remembered joking to Carlos once that they should both train as doctors and go open a free clinic in San Salvador.
"When we're rich."
But Adam doubted that his original, let alone the diminished version, was smart enough to learn to do much more than empty bedpans. He switched off the laptop and walked into the master bedroom. All of the old man's clothes were still there, as if he'd fully expected them to be used again. Adam took off his own clothes and began trying on each item in turn, counting the ones he was sure he recognized. Was he Gerald's Mr. 60%, or was it more like 40 or 30? Maybe the pep talks had been a kind of sarcastic joke, with the old man secretly hoping that the final verdict would be that there was only one Adam Morris, and like the studio's laughable deep learning bots, even the best technology in the world couldn't capture his true spark. He sat on the bed, naked, wondering what it would be like to go out in some wild bacchanalia with a few dozen robot fetishists, fucking his brains out and then dismembering him to take the pieces home as souvenirs. It wouldn't be hard to organize, and he doubted that any part of his corporate infrastructure would be obliged to have him resurrected from Lodestone's daily backups. The old man might have been using him to make some dementedly pretentious artistic point, but he would never have been cruel enough to render suicide impossible. Adam caught sight of a picture of the two men posing hamily beneath the Hollywood sign and found himself sobbing dryly with, of all things, grief. What he wanted was Carlos beside him, making this bearable, putting it right. He loved the dead man's dead lover more than he was ever going to love anyone else, but he still couldn't do anything worthwhile that the dead man could have done. He pictured Carlos with his arms around him.
"Shh, it's not as bad as you think. It never is, cariño. We start with what we've got, and just fill in the pieces as we go.
You're not really helping, Adam replied. Just shut up and fuck me. That's all I've got left.
He lay down on the bed and took his penis in his hand. It had seemed wrong before, but he didn't care now. He didn't owe either of them anything. And Carlos, at least, would probably have taken pity on him and not begrudged him the unpaid guest appearance. He closed his eyes and tried to remember the feel of stubble against his thighs, but he wasn't even capable of scripting his own fantasy. Carlos just wanted to talk.
You've got friends, he insisted. You've got people looking out for you.
Adam had no idea if he was confabulating freely or if this was a fragment of a real conversation long past, but context was everything.
Not anymore, Cariño. Either they're dead or I'm dead to them.
Carlos just stared back at him skeptically, as if he'd made a ludicrously hyperbolic claim. But that skepticism did have some merit. If he knocked on Cynthia's door, she'd probably try to stab him through the heart with a wooden stake. But the amiable stranger who'd sat beside him at the funeral had been far keener to talk than Adam. The fact that he still couldn't place the man no longer seemed like a good reason to avoid him. If he came from the gaps, he must know something about them. Carlos was gone. Adam sat up, still feeling gutted. But no amount of self-pity was going to improve his situation. He found his phone and checked under introductions. He hadn't erased the contact details. The man was named Patrick Auster. Adam called the number.